History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, one thing is certain. There are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned they don't have to go untold. If we'll just take the time to ask a few questions of some of our more experienced neighbors, and more importantly, be patient enough to listen to what comes back our way, we are not going to regret it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And we always come out ahead in that process because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 76 years ago right now, the battle for an 8-square-mile hunk of volcanic land in the Pacific was about halfway through. Some initial estimates had suggested it might take just 3 days to capture Iwo Jima, but that was before they realized that the 11 miles of tunnels on that island had been largely unaffected by the pre-invasion bombardment. And by this point, 76 years ago, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th Marine Divisions had all suffered heavy casualties. You're going to hear about the Battle of Iwo Jima today through the memories of men who experienced it in different roles. And we're also going to tell you about one opportunity you have this month to honor the memory of the more than 6,800 Americans killed there, not to mention the more than 19,000 wounded. You're going to hear from someone who was wounded and about some who paid the ultimate price to secure what would become critical airstrips for American bombers in the latter stages of World War II. I want you to get a little perspective from veterans from each branch of service. The Marines, of course, who are most associated with Iwo Jima, but also Army, Navy, Army Air Corps, and Coast Guard. We'll start with a Navy man. Steve Marusich was a rear-facing gunner in a TBF Avenger torpedo bomber flying off of the escort carrier USS Bismarck Sea.
Well, I tell you, everyone was excited because it was the biggest fleet of ships I'd ever seen. There were hundreds of ships in the area, battleships, cruisers, heavy cruisers, destroyers, big carriers, and there were about a dozen of us little guys. And we were there for almost a week, and it was our responsibility to fly over the island and drop our bombs and try to make things difficult for the Japanese to get ready so that the Marines could come ashore.
When you say you'd never seen a bigger fleet, a bigger group of ships, when you got to Iwo Jima and you saw so much firepower on the American side, did you ever think, we need all this for this little island? Is that something that occurred to you?
Yes, I was surprised that the Japanese were so well fortified. They had to be all underground because that island was sure peppered every day for 6 or 7 days. The big 16-inch guns from the battleships and the big carriers had much more firepower than we did, but that was our duty to just go and drop bombs on the island and see if you could soften them up.
And when you were flying those missions and dropping bomb after bomb and knowing all these other planes were too, did you see anything down below that made you think that this was going to be much of a fight?
No, it didn't look that ominous. It was just an island with very little vegetation. And we kept wondering why the heck we were there, because it didn't look like there was much on the island to be fighting for. Although later on I found out that that airstrip was vital to the B-29s to hit Tokyo. So that was our mission, to see if we can't soften it up and maybe give the Marines a better chance to get the island.
For people who haven't been there, and I think most of us listening have not been to Iwo Jima, we've certainly seen pictures of the giant mound, Mount Suribachi on one end of the island, and then more of a flat strip going from there. What did it look like to you, and certainly from the air? Was there something striking about that location?
Nothing striking other than Suribachi at one end, and it looked like a real simple thing to get that island, but when you found out that there were thousands of Japanese underground, and the Marines had a heck of a time getting there because there was very little foliage or shrubs or anything to cover. So when they invaded that island, those Marines were outstanding and to be able to get those Japanese out of there.
And early on in that invasion, Steve, after your primary job of hitting the island before the invasion was done, there was a bit of a commotion aboard your carrier. What was that all about?
On the day that we met the enemy, my shipmate and I were sitting on the hangar deck aft on the starboard side, and we were getting ready to go eat. It was about 6:30 at night. And as we were sitting there talking, ready to go and to start our chow that night, why, the guns start firing off and the general quarter sounded. And we stood up and turned towards the bow of the ship. And just as we turned, the first suicide plane hit us about, 20 or 30 feet in, on the starboard side where my shipmate and I were standing. And we were blown down the hangar deck about, I would say maybe 20, 30 feet. And the explosion hit me in the back of the head and my back, my legs. And after laying there a few seconds, I got up and started walking towards the bow of the ship. And not walking very well, I was kind of wondering if my legs were broken or not. Anyway, by the time I got up forward about another 20, 30 yards, the second suicide plane came down and hit our above our after elevator and knocked our torpedoes off, and the torpedoes began exploding, and the ship was damaged very severely. And another half a minute or so, the skipper came on and told us to abandon ship. Moving forward, I went up to the forward gun sponson where there were, I think, 20-millimeter cannons. They had a big line over the side, and I was fortunate I got up that far, took my helmet off. My jacket was gone. It was blown off my back. And I went over the side on the big line, and after dropping a few feet, we're up about 45, 50 feet, and one of the shipmates above me was stepping on my hands. So I let go of the rope and went down about 25 feet and hit the water and started floating and swimming away from the ship. After that, we started congregating out in the sea. And because the Japanese were still in the area, the other ships couldn't turn their lights on because the Japs were still strafing us in the water and still firing at ships. So it was about 4 hours later that they began to pick us up and the lights came on, and they pulled me aboard a destroyer escort, and they picked up almost 400 of us, and I was fortunate to be put aboard the destroyer. We were given some alcohol nourishment. Most of us were very cold and had very little energy, and we took all our clothes off. They gave us new clothes. And the sailors on board that destroyer escort were very helpful in pulling all of us aboard and giving us some alcohol, either it was brandy or some other thing to take the chill off our bodies. And in those days, I wasn't familiar with that alcohol, so it was quite an exciting to get such heat in your stomach. So the next day, they took us into Iwo Jima and put us on a big transport and made it into a hospital ship. And it was right below Mount Suribachi. And later that morning, the skipper came on and announced to all of us, if they would look up on the mountain, you'll see the flag flying. And the flag went up on Iwo Jima, the one that most people in World War II recognize as a victory symbol for those Americans who wanted us to be successful in the war.
And I've heard a lot of stories that people have about where they were when they saw that flag go up, and it has symbolic value for just about everyone. But I imagine for you, as someone who's just had your ship sunk and you were almost killed, to see something like that probably had a lot of symbolic value for you.
It was very emotional to all of those sailors that were around me. They all were so enthused, and we're so happy that the Americans went up on that mountain and the Japs were still in that mountain because they were shooting at us in the harbor, and the Marines still got up there and put that flag up there, and the symbol of our flag sure is a freedom symbol to all the people of the world. I think we just can't imagine how much it means to us to see the flag flying and to know we're still free.
But what did that flag atop Mount Suribachi mean to the Marines fighting on Iwo Jima? Let's hear that perspective from Peter Rondero, who had turned 19 a month earlier and was one of the first Marines to land at Iwo Jima.
I know our platoon was right in the middle next to Hill 362. All of a sudden, there's all this noise. He said, what's going on? And by that time, my sergeant calls me. He says, hey, Pete, come over here. Look at the flag. The flag, yeah. So I looked up, and here it is, flying a Mount Suribachi. Wow, when I saw that, I got goose pimples. I almost cried, and I said, gee, it's almost over. It was really a sight because you could hear the horns of the ships and people firing their weapons, and everybody hear me screaming, really. It's one of the most happiest moments in our lives, but we forgot that there was a price we had to pay for it. In the Marine Corps, you learn a lot of things, and one of the things is that when you're going to reach your objective, you just got to charge, period. And if you get hurt, somebody's going to take care of you, the corpsmen, and they do a beautiful job. They make a decision whether how bad you are, and either you're taken to the beach or you're put aside and somebody will take care of you, period. I always thought, if I'm going to die, please give me a wound that won't hurt, and God bless whatever happens, you know. Mm-hmm. But I always did think of my family, my mother, my brothers and sisters. But we're supposed to be hardcore men and not think about things like that. But I'll tell you the truth, we all thought about our families, but we always did hope for that million-dollar wound that would take us off the island. It so happens I was assigned to Fox Company, 2nd Battalion, 27th Marine, and our destination was Red Beach 1, and we happened to be in the first wave.
The very first wave on the
very island. First wave. It's all like the book says. We had those walls of sand we had to crawl over and dash across the narrow neck of the island, right above, below, Mount Suribachi, and head north. There was a lot of casualties. It's just awful. I was scared, really. I was scared. But seeing my buddies getting hit and wounded, I had to go forward. We had to reach our objective, regardless of the causes, because that was what the plans were. Was supposed to be a 72-hour operation and turned out to be 36 days. At Quinto Point was cliffs, caves, and we would send out feelers. In other words, we send maybe a platoon or a company to see how the enemy was dug in. It so happens in our line, we were told to go check on a cliff and see how's everything go over there. So we went. And this fellow by the name Mike Ladich were advancing and pooping and peeking, and all of a sudden I see this movement. So I took aim and I shot, and I could see somebody go back. And I said, oh my God, I killed somebody. Not knowing who they were, but I mean, we knew it was the enemy. And I made a mistake. I didn't roll. I over to the left or right. And about that time I went to see what it was like in Wango. I got hit, and I passed out for a few seconds, and I grabbed my rifle and I started going back, and Mike looks at me and says, hey, you're wounded. I didn't feel anything but the blood just coming down, and a facial wound is bleeds easily, but there's a shock, and you don't feel anything.
You got hit,
yeah,
in the helmet, right?
Yeah, and it went between the steel helmet and the fiber, and it went ricocheting right around and right. Oh, if it wasn't.
It went between the steel helmet and the liner, which
yeah,
kind of like a chute for it to come right out.
Yeah,
the back
ricocheted
of the helmet
right around, yeah, and it almost ripped my ear off. So that was it, and I went to the corner with Paul Bradford. He looks at me and says, you're all right. He sprinkled a bit of sulfur powder and put a Band-Aid on. I said, go back to the front lines. Here I am. Oh, no kidding. Here I thought I was going to get shipped out, you know.
It wasn't quite $1 million.
No, it was not. It was a 2-bit wound. It wasn't dead center. If it was dead center, that would have gone. I would have been a goner. But after a few days, we went back to get some supplies. And you can see the stacks of rifles, stacks of helmets. And I looked at it and says, I'm not the only one that got hit like that. You know, there was a lot of helmets with the bullets right through them. So I was pretty lucky. I was very fortunate. But there's times when you think about who's the one that didn't come back. And you say, gee, you get a guilty feeling because, like I say, I came home and I had a family and job and everything. And I say, gee, see, here's where I'm getting all messed up. You think about your friends, you know, of them missing life, the blessings.
Nearly 7,000 Americans died in that 36-day battle for Iwo Jima. It is their memory that will be honored March 20th in a special honor walk organized by the Best Defense Foundation. You can participate wherever you are. In the past, that foundation, led by former All-Pro linebacker Donnie Edwards, has returned veterans to Iwo Jima to visit some of the very spots where they risked their lives. Given the pandemic, that isn't possible this year, but the Honor Walk is a great way to recognize the sacrifice of so many and to educate younger generations about the price that was paid there. You can sign up online at bdf.org, and I also have that link for you at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, we're going to pick up more perspective on what happened there from another Marine, yes, but also a man who had to fly a general into Iwo Jima in the thick of the battle, as well as someone who witnessed it all from a ship just offshore. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.